Jewish audio on Chabad.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Mendel Kaplan, spiritual leader at Chabad of Flamingo, in Thornhill, Ontario.
Today, we are going to finish Perek Shlishi, the chapter of Perkei Avos. The final Mishnah. Number 18, Mishnah Yudches. Take a look in the Siddur, end of chapter. So 286, end of chapter 3. This teaching is from Rabbi Eliezer Chisma. Some of you will notice in your Mishnah it says Ben Chisma, and the word Ben is in parentheses, because in all likelihood it doesn't belong there. Who is Rabbi Eliezer Chisma? What kind of name is Chisma? Usually, when there is something added onto the name, it usually would be either a parental name, even sometimes a grandparent, or oftentimes a city. Have you heard the expression the son of a city? Somebody hails from somewhere, so people refer to the city as the origin, the source of this very, very special leader, a great person. But Chisma is neither the name of Rabbi Eliezer's father, nor is it the name of a city. The word Chisma means to seal off, to complete. And the question is, how did Rabbi Eliezer get this name Chisma? The Medrash tells us in Vayikra Rabba that Rabbi Eliezer once came to a particular town, and they said, "Oh, Rabbi Eliezer, won't you please lead us in the services? Won't you be Peiris al Shema," which means to say Baruch Hu, and to initiate, to lead the blessings of Shema, and then to do the repetition of the Shemona Esrei. And Rabbi Eliezer was uncomfortable for whatever reason, so he said, "I can't do that well." So they said, "What? And they call you Rebbe? You can't even lead the services? Every bar mitzvah boy can lead the services." And Rabbi Eliezer was very, very upset by this. He felt very offended. And later Rabbi Akiva saw him, and he said to him, "Why do you look so crestfallen? What happened to you today?" And he said, "I came to this place, and he asked me to be the chazan, and I didn't want to, and I said I'm not comfortable, and everybody laughed at me." So the story goes that Rabbi Eliezer came back to the place later on, and then they asked him, and then he led the services, and everybody was very impressed by him. And after that, he became known as Chisma. He sealed, he locked the deal, he sealed it up. Others say that a similar story happened, not with a chazan. The Gemara in the Yerushalmi, as quoted by the Medrash Shmuel, says that the Belezer Chisma once came to cities, and they asked him questions in halacha. The truth is that not every scholar knows how to answer a question in halacha. There's a big difference between academic Torah learning and practical Torah learning. You can ask the greatest scientist sometimes will not know how to answer a simple medical question, because that's not his field of expertise. He's a research doctor. I have a person who is world famous research in cardiology, but don't ask him any practical questions. That's not his expertise. He can't perform a simple procedure. My grandfather, who should live and be well, once had to have an angioplasty. So he told the Rebbe, he asked the Rebbe for a bracha. So the Rebbe said to make sure that it's a good doctor. So he said, yeah, it's a good doctor. So the Rebbe said, "I don't mean a good doctor who's a good researcher. I mean a doctor who does angioplasty on a regular basis." In other words, somebody could be an excellent doctor, but he doesn't know how to do the practicalities of a specific procedure. When you're looking for a good doctor, somebody who's expert at that procedure, you don't need Einstein. You need the guy who knows how to do the angioplasty. So Rabbi Eliezer came to this place and they asked him questions in halacha, and it seems Rabbi Eliezer was not sure of the answers. Tremendous scholar, tremendous Torah researcher, but not a practical halachic person. So the story goes, he felt very, very low because of this, and he felt bad about himself, and he went back and he applied himself stringently to the study of halachic discipline. And they said after that, he came back to the city and they called him Chisma because he sealed everything. There wasn't a single area which he had left untouched or unsealed. Everything he perfected. And he knew all of practical halacha that anybody could possibly ask him. So this is where the name Chisma comes from. Either way, it would seem that Rabbi Eliezer Chisma was a great expert on practicality, practical Judaism, on halacha Judaism. Not just in theory, not just in an area which is called Pilpul, but the area called Halacha. Anything that had to be done Rabbi Eliezer was an expert. And so, Rabbi Eliezer was a disciple of Rabbi Gamliel, and a disciple of Rabbi Yeshua, two outstanding sages of the time. Just to put it in perspective, last week's Mishnah we talked about Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah replaced Rabbi Gamliel as the Nasi because Rabbi Gamliel offended Rabbi Yeshua, or was upset with Rabbi Yeshua. That's a long story in and of itself. So these are all peers, all around the same time. Rabbi Elazar Chisma is a disciple of Rabbi Gamliel and of Rabbi Yeshua. And the story is told that Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Gamliel were once traveling on a ship, and Rabbi Yeshua had extra food, more provisions with him. And Rabbi Gamliel said, "Why did you bring so many provisions?" He said, "Because there's a star that appears only every 70 years, and the astrological or zodiac meaning of the star is that the ships are going to be lost. So therefore, I expect the ship to get lost, and that's why I bring extra provisions." Now, Rabbi Gamliel was a very wealthy man. He was a descendant of the great sage Hillel, and they had what was called Bei Nasiya, the house of Jewish leadership, and there was tremendous wealth. The grandson of Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yehuda, was known to be the wealthiest in all of Israel. It says that he was as wealthy as the Roman emperor, Roman Caesar Antoninus. So Rabbi Gamliel said to Rabbi Yeshua, who was poor as a church mouse, he said to him, "If you're so smart, how come you can't make a living?" Like, he wasn't saying it to offend him. Like, what's going on here? Like, you have it all figured out.
So, yeah,
like, right? You ever see the expression, "If you're so smart, how come you're not wealthy?" So, what's going on over there? So, Rabbi Yeshua said to him, "Why are you asking that question of me? You have two of your greatest disciples, one of whom was this Rabbi Elazar." He said, "Rabbi Elazar knows how to measure every single drop of water in the ocean." I have no clue what that means, but that's what he said. And yet, Rabbi Elazar is terribly, terribly poor. He can't make a living. The story goes that when Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yeshua came back from the voyage, Rabbi Gamliel immediately sent for Rabbi Elazar, and he said that he wanted to promote him to a position of extreme leadership. This way he'll make a living. So Rabbi Elazar demurred. He didn't want to come. So Rabbi Gamliel said, "You think it's honor I'm giving you? Trust me, if you're going into a position of leadership in the Jewish world, it's only going to be grief and hard work." And the story was that Rabbi Eliezer later was promoted, and he had, a job that was able to pay wages. So, what do we know about Rabbi Eliezer Chisma? We know that he's an expert in halacha. We also know that he's an expert in natural sciences. He was an expert. A person who simply knew everything and knew it expertly. And this Rabbi Elazar ben Chisma, we know, is also very poor, and he's going to give us lessons of life. A very short lesson, and on the surface it seems to be almost irrelevant. Kinin u'pischei nida, the laws of kinin and the laws of establishing the calendar for a menstruant. Hein hein gufe halachas. This is the body of halacha. So before we go into any deep understanding of the Mishnah, let's try to understand literally. What are kinin? The word kinin, literally, refers to a set of birds, a pair of birds. And it gets its name from the nest of a bird, which in Hebrew is called a kin. Kansipa. Kansipa is a bird's nest. So kinin nests are the expression that's used to describe pairs of birds. And the Torah tells us that there are certain instances when a person would have to bring a pair of birds as a sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash. Invariably it would usually be a pigeon or a dove. One was brought in its youth, in its infancy, and one was brought only after it matured. Then comes the question, what happens? The birds have wings, you know, and birds are sometimes indistinguishable. It's hard to know which bird is which. Once you set a bird aside as a sacrifice, what happens if the bird flies from one place to the other, and now you don't know which bird flew where? So you have a problem now. What kind of sacrifice do you bring? And also these two birds, each one had a unique sacrifice supposed to be brought. So what do you do when this gets mixed up? And then if you had one bird from here that flew to the other side and now joined the other birds, and then a bird from the other one joined and flew back to the first one. What do you do then? What if birds from either now flew to a third location? And this gets very complicated. It sounds ridiculous, I know, but this was a real life issue they had to deal with. It's interesting that in Israel today we have some archaeological digs that show us that raising birds was a very respected profession at the time, it seems. People would dig into caves and they would have these little birdhouses, a little area, so they raised birds. Some of these were homing pigeons, which used for communication purposes. They're also used for purposes of eating. It seems like people ate more pigeons and more doves than they ate chicken, in like we eat in today's day and age. A pigeon is kosher, yes. So these halachas is actually an entire tractate called Kinyan. And the whole tractate of Kinyan is based on what if. What if I set aside birds, and what if one bird flew to the other side? What if one bird flew to the third group, and what if the third group is mixed with the fourth group? What if the fourth group gets mixed with the sixth group? And how do I know how many sacrifices to bring and what to do with these sacrifices? And these calculations are enough to drive anybody crazy. And it's an entire tractate at the end of Kachim, at the end of the laws of sacrifices and issues, notions that deal with the Beis HaMikdash. This tractate is called Kinyan. And then the last tractate of the order of Mishnah known as Taharas is called Nida. And Nida deals with the laws of menstruation. Now, in today's day and age, I have to tell you that the laws of menstruation are fairly straightforward and simple. Woman menstruates, wait 5 days, make a hefsek tahara, know that you're clean, you wait 7 days, you go to the mikveh. It's fairly straightforward. It does get confusing also because the truth is that we're supposed to keep the calendar. And we're supposed to know approximately when we're expecting the next period. This is called Vestas. And there are actually three kinds of Vestas. Something called the Vesta Chedesh, something called Vesta Floga, which means that we have to count how many times from one period to the next. And then we're going to assume that if it was 39 days between one and the next, that's going to be the period will arrive in another 39 days. And then in another 39 days. I'm just picking a number out of a hat. A ridiculous number. That's nothing to do with reality necessarily. Right? But everybody's different. And then we have the day of the Hebrew month. When did it arrive? So it arrived, let's say, on the 13th day of the Hebrew month. Then we say that a woman's body has a lot to do with the lunar pole. So therefore, the next time it's the 13th day of the month again, we're going to look up. It's called the Vesta Chedesh. We're going to expect this to be on the same kind of day. And keeping a calendar is actually quite a onerous thing to do. But it's not nearly as onerous as it was in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, when there was actually two kinds of nida, something called a nida and something called a zava. And it could be a zava ktana and a zava gdela. And the calculations are unbelievable. According to the Gemara, it's possible for somebody to have to go to the mikveh up to 95 times because of questions that can arise. Between 35 to 95 times. So trust me, well, we have it very easy today. And these cheshbonos, these calculations are all based on somebody forgot. She forgot to mark down, so she doesn't know. So now what does she do? Well, now we have another question, and another question, because, you know, every question begets another question, and because they have all these doubts, so they have endless calculations that have to get made. So Blazer Chisma says, these calculations that come out of an accident, out of a mistake, where people simply forgot to keep the numbers and forgot to make the calculations previously, those are gufei halachas. Those are the body of halacha. Tkufeis ugematriyais, the wisdom of astrology, the discipline of studying the heavens, the cosmos, and gematriyais, which simply stated seems to mean the numerology of letters. You know that in Hebrew, the letter Aleph stands for one. The letter Beis, the second, stands for two. And so on and so forth, until the letter Yud, which stands for 10. Chaf stands for 20. Lamed stands for 30. Until we get to Kuf. Kuf stands for 100. Resh stands for 200. Shin stands for 300. And Tuf stands for 400. So just so you have an idea of what we're talking about, who knows what the Hebrew year, this Hebrew year, is called in Hebrew. How do we say it in Hebrew? Anybody know? Tav, Shin, Samach, Zayin. What is the Hebrew year in English? 5, 7, 6, 7. So let's try to add that up now. Tav is 400. Tough shin. Shin is 300. Gives you what? 700. Samach is 60. Zion is 7. So tough shin, samach, zion would add up to what number? 767. Well, now you should ask me the question, if the year is 5767, why does Tavshin Samach Zayin only stand for 767? So what's the answer? The answer is that we count every 1,000 years individually. So the first 1,000 is Aleph, meaning first millennia number 1, Tavshin Samach Zayin. Then there's millennia number 2. You know which millennia we're in now? We're in, actually, 5 millennia have passed already. We're now in the 6th millennia. So, if you want to write out the Hebrew year in full, you write the letter Hey with a dash, which means 5,000 years have already passed. Tavshin Samach Zayin, meaning in the 6th millennia, 767. This is the numerology of Hebrew letters. So, every one of the Hebrew letters also represents a number. Sometimes we take a look at names that people have, or names of places, and we're able to draw a correlation between the numerology of a number, of that name, for example, and the numerology of a day, or the numerology of a place. Now, there's a lot of Narishkeit mixed into this, because not every time the numbers match up doesn't necessarily mean something. You have to be like an inspired person to know how to look at numbers, or when to look at numbers. It's not it's not something for the common person. That's the truth. Sometimes it's cute, but to say that it's actually meaningful, it takes a bit of a stretch. So, Rav Elazar Chisma says that figuring out the zodiac, understanding the stars, the cosmos, and playing games with Hebrew letters, this is just par kadosh l'chachma. This is hors d'oeuvres, according to the Maharal, and according to the Bartanura, it refers to the dessert. So whether its point is, it's finger food. It's not the real meal. It's not either it's there to whet your appetite, or it's there to wash the food down. Now, hors d'oeuvres and dessert taste slightly different, but either one fits in the same category. The common denominator of both hors d'oeuvres and dessert is that neither is the meal. It's there just as kind of an appetizer, something to get your meal going, or simply to wash the food down. The truth is that most people love appetizers and desserts. There's some people that try to make their meal into desserts or appetizers, and it's usually not a healthy thing to do. You can eat appetizers, but that's not a meal. You could eat dessert, but it's also not a meal. Now, children usually love appetizers and love dessert. You have a very hard time getting them to sit down and eat the meal. You ever notice that? Tell the kids, they love those little hot dogs and the little sushi, and they run for it. Right? But you have to sit them down actually at the table, you have a hard time. And dessert, forget about it. If it's sweet or whatever, the kids are running. But that's not healthy. A healthy, balanced, mature adult knows that appetizers are nice and dessert is sweet. But a meal, that's what it's all about. That's the simple interpretation, the simple understanding of this Mishnah. What is the Mishnah saying to you? What's the point? Kufi halacha is parparois. This is the body of the halacha, and this is the hors d'oeuvres, this is the appetizer. What is Rebbe Elazar Chisma trying to tell us? How should you walk away from this Mishnah? Inspired? Enlightened? Bewildered? Go ahead. Okay, Carol, the Torah study is more important than other Torah studies. But to Kufis, studying the calendar is not other than Torah study. In fact, it's very, very important for Jewish people to know how to create a calendar. Because we need to know how to arrange the seasons. Why? Because Hashem wants that the holidays should be celebrated in a seasonal way. So actually, it takes tremendous wisdom to devise a calendar. It's interesting to point out that the Jewish calendar that we have today is based on the math and research that was done by the great sage Hillel. Do you know how long our calendar is going for continuously now? Over 2,100 years. Close to 2,200 years. Do you know that there has never been a mistake in our calendar? You know, the Christian calendar, the Gregorian calendar, has had to be adjusted 3 times. The Muslim calendar, which is much younger, has had to be adjusted a number of times already. There has never yet been a mistake in our calendar. And it just balances. Keeps balancing up. Every 21 years balances up. And if he didn't learn this from somebody, because there was nobody to learn it from, nobody had such a calendar. Hillel created this calendar on his own. And if Hillel would not have done that, we would be in big trouble today. So the question then is, so the Elezer, Rabbi Elezer Chisma is telling you that you have to study the boring parts of Torah. Everything's important. So why does he call it only hors d'oeuvres? If everything is equally important, then he should say you have to study everything. He seems to create a lack of parity. He's saying they're not equal. There's kinin u'pischa nida, and that's guf, that's the body. You know what happens when you have a soul without a body? We call it a ghost. Nobody likes ghosts.
We don't believe in ghosts.
Who doesn't believe in ghosts? Listen, ghost is a very, very broad word. Are there souls without bodies? Does such a thing exist? It does. It does. Do they come and haunt your house on Halloween? No. Is there such a concept? Is there a concept of the neshama without a guf? Could be such a concept. There have been stories like that over the ages. All these ideas, whether they're popular in Christian or Celtic cultures or in Sanskrit or whatever it is, all these ideas have ultimately traced their way back to the Torah. It's all there in the Torah. You know, I did a television show last week, and there's this Muslim guy, and they're talking about inner strength, and he says the great prophet said that who is really strong, the one who can overcome his inclination. Sounds very familiar. The great prophet said that's a Mishnah. Like, unbelievable. Pashat stole a Mishnah. I guess he figures, who's going to go look at the Mishnah? Nobody knows he's a plagiarist. It's unbelievable. Straight out of the Torah. And lots of things. And I talk to, you know, other quote-unquote faith leaders. They tell me things. Yeshka said. Muhammad said it. I don't know. The Gemara says it.
If it's a Jew, it doesn't matter. Islam or Christians, if it's educated people, they know it's from Torah.
I don't know. They certainly would deny that it's from Torah. He's saying it comes from his prophet, but it just doesn't. I made sure to point out that the Mishnah says, and the Mishnah, I said, is 2,300 years old. The Mishnah says, "Ezel Giber Akevish." And I translate it just to make the point. Nobody should plagiarize what says in Torah. But the point that I want to make, though, is. What I want to make is a body is a very important thing. Now, of course, a body without a soul is also scary. Nobody likes corpses either. We like to have a body and a neshama. But when we say the body of something, we're talking about, you know, what's most important. That which you really need. Everybody needs to have. You need the meat, so to speak. You need the body. You need the goof. Then you can have other things also added on. I'll give you an example of a body. Forget body and soul, because it's not a good metaphor here. A bird has a body. And a bird has wings. What happens if a bird has clip wings? It can't fly. But could it live? Yeah. In fact, it's halacha in the laws of Tzeifus, nitla agafeha, that if the wings are clipped, kosher, still a kosher bird. What happens if you have wings and no body? You make a feather pillow. You have nothing. Right? Wings without a body and nothing. So therefore, mystically speaking, if we say that the body of the mitzvah is doing the mitzvah, and then the passion and the fervor of the mitzvah, that's like wings. That takes the mitzvah and lifts it up to heaven. But you have to have the body. If you don't have the body, you have nothing. So when the Kabbalah said to sit you down and they make an 8-hour meditation on the reading of the Megillah, they really do this, by the way, and they don't actually read the Megillah, you have nothing. You leave 8 hours later, you did not fill the mitzvah. If you meditate on the meaning of the sounds of the shofar, but nobody actually blows the shofar, you have nothing. Because you need a body. The wings are very nice. It's a nice addition. It makes the body more appreciated. But it will not transform or make the difference that the mitzvah has to make. So Rabbi Elezer Chisma says, kinin u'pischa nida, these obscure halachas, which very few people actually master, that's gufa halacha, that's the body of halacha. Tkufa is a gematriyais, these numerology and making calendar, which is a very important thing. That's paparois, it's an appetizer. That's not what's really most important. So Powell makes a very good point. He's trying to say you have to study even the halacha. But I'm asking back, okay, even the halacha, but here he doesn't say kin mepischanidus are as important as tkufas igmatiyos. He says that's good gufa halachas. That's what halacha is all about. And the rest, the other areas of Torah, they're interesting. They're nice. They're entertaining. But it's parpar oysa chachma. It's just an appetizer or dessert. That's not what Torah is really all about. So, again, I'm asking this question of you. What does this Mishnah say to you? What is the point the Mishnah is trying to make? It doesn't have to be the right answer. Just tell me what it's saying to you. How do you feel about this? You could have dinner without dessert.
Yeah.
Huh? You can't have an appetizer without... you can have dinner without appetizers.
Yeah.
The main course, as long as you serve... If you invite everybody to a wedding and you didn't serve hors d'oeuvres and you didn't serve an appetizer but you serve the main course, you get away with it. If all you serve is hors d'oeuvres and dessert, it's going to be a very strange situation. Okay. So what is the point you're trying to make? Make sure you have dessert?
No, just if you want
it. I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I promise. Please.
It's like there's a good meal and there's an okay meal. Right? So you can just do one part of study, but you're not getting the whole trip.
Okay, so what you're saying is, what this Mishnah says to you is, that in addition to the body, the technical part of Judaism, that there needs also to be something entertaining, some interesting tidbits, the wings. Okay?
The compliment. Healthy diet without any dessert and without any appetite.
I think most doctors would advise you not to have dessert, actually. One second, sorry, then, or yes, ma'am?
Can I teach you that? Like, everything here is in short form. So basically, it's just kind of telling you, like, little things, and you have to go back. Learn everything into more detail. There's so much more to learn.
How do you see that in the Mishnah, though? That you have to go learn deeper. Which part of the Mishnah is saying that to you? The comparison of gufi alochas, the parparois, the body of the loch. Which part is saying to you that you have to? There's more than meets the eye. I agree with you. There is more than meets the eye. But that's what you feel the Mishnah is saying to you. Okay. Yes, Carol. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying that the Mishnah is talking to people who maybe don't know, people who are ignorant, they don't understand, and they're going to get stuck with the hors d'oeuvres and dessert, never going to make it to the main course, never appreciate the main course. Like the perfect example, like children. It's exactly what kids do. They really don't get it. They're not interested in brisket. They don't care about baked potatoes.
And then you learn, the more you learn, the more you want to learn.
And then the more you start to appreciate that you need a main course. Just like somebody who starts to eat, you get a little older. So everything everybody's saying is correct. It's all correct things. I'm going to try to just sew it all together now and put the Mishnah into perspective. It's interesting that the Belezer chooses kinin upischenida. Very obscure halachas. Not only are the obscure halachas, the obscure halachas that speak about a situation that's created by doubt. A situation that's created out of a lack of scrutiny. We weren't careful, we weren't meticulous, so now we have these questions. So there's a halachic way to deal with it. And then another, I forgot this too, so I forgot something else, so I wasn't careful about something else. Another layer, there's something, another detail of halacha that now gets added in. What is the most popular study of Judaism today in the world? Kabbalah. Why is Kabbalah so popular? It's a fashion. Tell me, did you ever find halacha go into fashion? Everybody wants to learn halacha. Please teach me kinyan. I need to know those laws of the bird who flew to the other bird. Nobody's like interested. Like it never. I guarantee you, it's never going to take off. There is never going to be a time when pischei nida is all the rage. It's just not going to happen. There have been times when gematria was very popular. In gematria, gets phased out. Astrology is very popular. Still very popular, by the way. And then times when spirituality is very popular, Kabbalah is very popular. This can go through waves of popularity, things that are interesting, like candy. That's sweet. You taste it, and it tastes wonderful, and your teeth fall out 5 years later because you ate too much candy. Or you sit and stuff yourself on the dervish, and eventually you get sick because you can't sustain yourself. It's not a normative diet.
I think when they're trying to learn Kabbalah, they think they're going to get the answers right away.
Yeah, I think you could say that Kabbalah has an allure that it's going to give answers, it's going to give secrets, it's going to give you magic, things that nobody else knows. It has like this incredible shrouded mystique about it. Although I have to tell you that 40 years ago, nobody was interested in it. They were interested in Zen Buddhism. They were interested in this is the, you know, the Jewish wave of spirituality or mysticism. And I have a feeling that in 10 years, nobody's going to be interested in it either. It's going to be so passe. Like, who wants to meditate now? Leave me alone. Who wants to go to an ashram? Your kids do not want to go to an ashram. They want to smoke pot maybe, but the ashram is of no interest. They're not interested in going there. Why is it? Why is it that people get excited or turned on by flashy things, by things that are interesting and cute and different and entertaining? Because everybody wants a shortcut. Nobody wants to do the hard work. The truth is that Judaism is a fulfilling path. The truth is that Judaism and Torah offers one happiness. Sense of true gratification. But it doesn't happen quickly. Like any good thing in life, it happens very slowly. Why is the Atkins diet so popular? Because it offered you incredible, because it's wrong? Well, it's wrong because it's the shortcut. The right things are not shortcuts. The right things, the true things, almost always take a great deal of effort. That's a rule. So anything that offers you to lose an incredible amount of weight in an incredibly short amount of time, there's got to be something wrong with it. And the fact that it's so effective can only make you so scared of what else it does. Because obviously it makes a huge impact on your body. Eating healthy is a very good thing. Eating healthy is a way of life. Eating healthy is not a crash, 1, 2, 3. Now it is true that sometimes going on an Atkins diet or some kind of other crazy diet shows a person they actually could lose weight. And from there, they may enter into a healthy lifestyle. So you know what, I lost this weight, I feel good about it, I need to keep this weight off. How am I going to do that? Well, then you go and you set a lifestyle up where you're actually going to start living in a normal way that keeps you healthy. So what did the Atkins diet turn out to be? Let's use a metaphor of food.
Appetizer.
An appetizer. An hors d'oeuvre. It got you into the swing of things. You got to taste weight loss. Ooh, it tastes good. Doesn't taste good, but feels good. So if it feels good, how do I keep up with this? How do I make sure to be able to sustain it? And then comes the long path. Many other things in life are like that. An example in Torah is sometimes Kabbalah. People get very excited. Ooh, mystical. Spooky-jooky stuff. It's magical. It's mystique. It's very interesting. And sometimes people get involved in Yiddishkeit because of that. If they're lucky, what happens? This Jewish stuff is, it's not as bad as I thought. Forget converting. Forget converting. How about the lost Jews of Thornhill? They don't have to convert. They have to come home. We need to get to those Jews, right? How do we get to those Jews? So Madonna and Britney Spears did us a big favor, the way I look at it. They popularized a part of Judaism, so now I actually can get a Jew to come into show for a part of Judaism. What's that, Kabbalah? No problem. I've been in Hasidus my whole life. Sure, great. The hope is, of course, that somebody will say, ooh, so this is Torah, so this is Yiddishkeit. Give me more. And then from a Kabbalah class or a lecture, they start to come to other classes, and they start learning Chumash, and they start learning Gemara, and they start learning Mishnah. Ooh, this is very interesting. Maybe I should come to Daven once in a while. You know what? I'm learning about all these things. Shabbos is so hard to incorporate into my life. Maybe at least an hour of Shabbos. Let me taste it. Is kashrus impossible? Maybe the mikvah is not such a bad thing after all. And so on and so forth. So these things can serve as conduits. They can serve as entryways. Sometimes they can serve as dessert. Sometimes you study, and you really work hard on understanding a pasuk of Chumash, a verse of Chumash, and Rashi's commentary. And then at the end, you can give an enlightening, mystical perspective. And it kind of just... it sews it all up. It feels good. You had a good meal, then you had a nice dessert after, and you just leave feeling very satisfied. You ate something light after. It brings it all together and makes it feel good. But life can't be based on just those quick experiences, on those easy experiences. Life and Judaism and spiritual growth is based on the long, hard way. And the long, hard way, the body of halacha, so to speak, says Rabbi Elazar Chisma, who's the expert, the bucky in everything, is kinin upischinida. Is the ideas of halacha. Which halacha? Okay, I learn halacha. Tell me how to keep Shabbos. Tell me how to... I want to know how to bake challah. Is there a halacha for that? Yeah, actually there's a halacha for that too. How about halachas of what if something happened and somebody said that somebody forgot and now what should we do? And then another case came, oh, leave me alone already, whatever, it's good enough. No, no, it's not good enough. You have to do the right thing according to halacha. So we choose over here the very end of the halacha, the end of the order of taharis, of kutchin, pardon me. Kutchin deals with laws of the Beis HaMikdash. And you say to yourself, Beis HaMikdash, we haven't had one in 2,000 years. What difference does that make to me? There's halacha for that too. And I have to know the halacha. Taharis, this is the only detail, nidah is the only laws of purity and impurity actually able to keep today. And go to the very end of that tractate and have all these questions of what if, what if, what if. And a lot of these what ifs are actually not even practical today. But it's the halacha. So when somebody studies the halacha, like Rabbi Elazar Chisma, seals it up, studies everything, every detail, you know that Yiddishkeit is a real path, and this is what God wants. Hashem wants you to do X, Y, and Z if the circumstances are X, Y, and Z. And He wants you to do X, Y, A if the circumstances are X, Y, A, and so on and so forth. That is the real path, the normative path of Judaism. And that's the path everybody has to learn to follow. It's not an easy one. It's a very challenging one. It's onerous. It may be boring. It may be tedious. But that's Gufa Halachas. That's the body of Halacha, the body of Judaism. Going into other areas which deal with fascinating natural sciences and Torah, it really is interesting. It may serve as an appetizer, it may serve as a conduit, it may serve as a dessert. It's proper lois for chachma. It's all Torah. It's all beautiful wisdom. Yes. But that's not the essence of Yiddishkeit. The essence of Yiddishkeit is following the halacha, doing what God wants. The Rebbe asks a question. He says, why of all things does he choose tkufos, which seem to be very, very meaningful, and is related to natural sciences, and gematria? Is gematria a number of words like numerology? What's the point? So he says that it's brought down in the commentaries that gematriois actually refers to geometry. And geometry is the knowledge of measuring earth. So he says we have here the measuring of two forms of natural science. The sciences of the heavens, the sciences of the cosmos, and the sciences of earth. Which actually, of course, reminds us of the Gemara that we learned earlier that Rabbi Yeshua said about his disciple, or about their disciple, Rabbi Gamliel, that Rabbi Elazar Chisma knows how to measure every drop of water in the ocean. Which, as I said, I don't know what that means, but it implies an incredible mastery of the knowledge of earth, of the natural sciences of earth, the measurement of earth, how to be able to look at the geometric perspective of something that you see. So here we have represented the sciences, the fascination of heaven and of earth, which we could, of course, expand upon and say the cosmos, the stars, not only refers to calendars, but refers also to seeing. People look at this, you know, seeing the zodiac. Sometimes you can see the mazel of what certain mazel is going to bring. It starts to border on something very mystical, being able to look into the future. And we talk about the sciences of earth, talk about unlocking the natural resources of earth, not only knowing how to measure earth, how to harness energy. So all these types of wisdom, which are fascinating and inspiring and entertaining, and it can be found in the Torah itself, that could serve as a par peroish l'chachma. You have to make sure to have a well-balanced diet. So the truth is that Perek Shlishi, the third chapter of Pirkei Avos, ends with such an important message. It's so relevant in our times, it's unbelievable. That here we live in an age in a society where Judaism is almost back in the vogue. I didn't say all the way almost. It's almost not strange to go to a Torah class. People are doing it. People are interested. There's an awakening. Not only amongst Jews, even amongst Gentiles. People are curious to know, what is this ancient wisdom about? And there's a big danger there. And the danger is that we get caught up in the hors d'oeuvres and the appetizers, and we miss the point. You have a person who comes to classes, runs all over the city from one Kabbalah class to another Kabbalah class, from one mystical idea, from another science and Torah lecture to another one. Practically speaking, you're doing mitzvahs? Now leave me alone. I'm not superstitious. I'm not into that basic stuff. I'm into the interesting stuff. I'm into the gymnastics, the dynamics, the fireworks of Torah. Rabbi Elazar Chisma, who is the expert of all knowledges, says you have to always bring it back to a practical level. And the practical level is gufei halacha, so that a Jew has to study halacha, and a Jew has to know how to practically implement the will of Hashem into our lifestyles, to integrate the way of Torah into the way that we live. Which is not to say that it's a bad thing to advertise Kabbalah lectures and this type of fascinating science, or that type of fascinating natural history, and how it is able to be sewn together with Torah. It's great. First of all, it's a way to get people in the door, and that feels good. Secondly, it's a way to keep people inspired, because when you're learning basic halacha, sometimes it could get a little tedious, and sometimes you want to see a little more. Just like eventually, you had enough of the brisket, you want to have a little dessert. You had enough of the caramelized mushrooms and onions. You want to have something different. You want to have something unique, and that's fine. It's a good thing, and it's a proper thing, and it's an appropriate thing. And that's a well-balanced diet of Judaism, where we make sure we have the goof, we have the body, we have the technical side of Judaism, we're fulfilling the mandate that Hashem placed upon us, and at the same time, we're discovering the wonderment, the amazement, the beauty that's found in every single facet and every single detail of the Torah. And how does Rabbi Elazar Chisma give us this lesson in two cryptic sentences, which really is inspirational in and of itself? Two sentences which on face value, you read them, doesn't seem to have any major meaning. Alright, fine. Alright, so geometry in there. Okay. But actually, that's the key to spirituality in today's day and age. And in a sense, it speaks to the entire population. It speaks to the illiterate, if you will, or unlettered, uninitiated Jewish population that has nothing. And it speaks to us and says, how do we get to them? It gives you the trick. That's the emphasis. Most of the commentaries tell us that it's not dessert, but it's an appetizer. Market the Torah. You market it well, you share interesting things about Torah, people get excited. You get them in the door. And at the same time, it reminds us that you can't only have a life of halacha. You can't only study the technical side of Judaism, because otherwise you become a robot. That there needs to be dessert once in a while. Nothing wrong with that. It's a good thing. It's a healthy thing. There are people who want to stay away from it. Oh, Kabbalah, leave me alone. I study the Talmud. I'm just dealing with all the technical parts of Torah. And someday when I master that, I'll be able to go on to have something else. You know, like, you eat many meals in a day. You eat many meals in a lifetime. It's nice to have a balance. In the yeshiva system, the Lubavitch yeshiva system, we study Chassidus in the morning, we study Chassidus in the evening. You have an appetizer that starts a day off, you have dessert that ends the day, but the vast majority of the day is devoted to Talmud and codes, because that's goofy halachas. You can't be a Jew, you can't be certainly a rabbi, without knowing goofy halachas and knowing the practical side of Judaism. It's very important. And time-wise, it has to take up the lion's share of the day, or the lion's share of one's academic study. But it's necessary on either end, as appetizer, as dessert. And this is, of course, what does Chassidus want from us? Chassidus doesn't want that we should be something different than Jews who keep Torah mitzvahs. Chassidus doesn't come along and say, you don't have to keep mitzvahs, it's okay. As long as you feel passion for Judaism, that's good enough. As long as you're excited and exuberant, that's fine. Chas v'shalom. Chassidus wants everybody to learn and to daven and do everything else everybody is doing. I'll use the word I hate, to be orthodox, or to try to strive to be observant of mitzvahs. But Chassidus says not enough. That observance has to be punctuated with a sense of passion. That learning and that doing has to be filled with a sense of exuberance and joy and excitement. And if it's not, then something's missing. We have, in most of the things that we do well, we have a passion for it. If we wouldn't have a passion for it, we wouldn't do it well. We would be forced into it. We would do it with a sense of resignment, a sense you have no choice. Why should we do that? Some people never enter a marriage where they're resigned to a marriage. No passion for it. They wish they were 1,000 miles away, but they have no choice, they feel. I'm not saying that they should break up the marriage, but I'm saying that they should find a way to fill it with passion. Find a way to rekindle the marriage. Not just say, okay, I'll resign to it, I'll technically survive and I'll do the right thing, but rather, I need to make this work, and to make it work means that it should become an exciting experience.
It's impossible.
Impossible. Impossible is a very, very big word. How do you know what's impossible?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. So you should know as a rule like this. If you're in a business arrangement and it doesn't seem like it's going to work, I suggest that you sever the ties. If you're in a friendship and it doesn't seem to work, sever the ties, move on. If you're in a shul that doesn't work for you, say goodbye and move on. If you're in a marriage, you work and work and keep working at it. Because it's not just an option to sever the ties and move on. Of course it is an option. That's not really an option. That's the difference. We go into a business partnership, we don't send another chuppah with a business partner. Have a rabbi come and make brachas and commit, we're going to run this business and we're going to run it well. And then they're going to have to get divorced because the business doesn't work. There is no other partnership in life, bar none. And there are lots of partnerships. Human experience is probably more about relationship than anything else. There is no other partnership in life in which there is the sacred ceremony in which something transcendent takes place, like a marriage. Nothing else. Listen, unfortunately, if marriages don't work, we're allowed to get remarried. And the Torah says we always have a second kick at the can. But you should know, as a rule, that the concept of marriage is not a disposable one.
But
the Torah says in this past parsha, if it doesn't work. I'm very uncomfortable using the word, it's a mitzvah to give a gift. I told you that there was a visit by the chief rabbis of Israel. The Sephardic and Ashkenazi chief rabbi came together to the Rebbe in 1988, I think it was, or 89. And they were discussing. It was a very scholarly discussion. And amongst the things that were said, they mentioned something about divorce. And the Ashkenazi chief rabbi at the time muttered, sometimes it's a mitzvah to get divorced. And this is on video. And the Rebbe gives him this icy stare, and he says, Chas v'shalom. God forbid, we should never hear of such things amongst the Jewish people. So the attitude, a callous attitude, yeah, alright, doesn't work, divorce, big deal, move on, we've been through this before. That's not the right attitude. The right attitude is that a marriage, once you commit to a marriage, you have to keep working on it and keep working on it, keep working and keep working. Huh?
If you hate, for example.
Well, last week's parsha says, if you hate the person, you have to leave the person. The question is you have to hate the person? Okay, yes is yes. Well, I tell you, the Torah says